Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here is your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Thank you and welcome to Frankly Speaking here on the TurfNet Radio Network. I'm Frank Rossi, associate professor at Cornell University, extension turfgrass specialist for New York State. And we're on another episode of Frankly Speaking, this time with a colleague of mine from Auburn University, Professor Scott McElroy, a member of the Faculty of Crop and Soil and Environmental Sciences at Auburn University, a professor of turfgrass and weed science. And the conversation with Scott today goes back to some of my own roots in my academic life. I got my PhD here at Cornell in 1990 in weed science. So I spent a number of years doing weed science research, and even though most of my academic career up to this point has not included a lot of weed work, I certainly stay abreast of this kind of work as it's going on in the turfgrass industry. And really at the forefront, you've got a number of wonderful young weed scientists, Jim Brosnan, Sean Askew, Pat McCullough, and of course our guest today, Scott McElroy. And Scott, one of the things we talked about in preparation for our conversation today is the sort of growing concern and the amount of research that's not only underway, of course, in production agriculture, but now really with you from a genomics perspective, as well as a mechanistic perspective, trying to understand herbicide resistance. And as we were talking about earlier, this is not commonly discussed, I would say, north of the Mason-Dixon line, to be honest. We just have not really heard much about this. I certainly am aware of it because of its preponderance in other crops, and there certainly are those crops in northern climates that have herbicide resistance and in some cases multiple chemistry resistance that I remember, you know, the Australians stumbling into that multiple resistant ryegrass a number of years ago, you know, well, 20, 30 years ago now. And so as this moves to be more important in turf management, at least it's coming into my sphere primarily through annual bluegrass, when we were having our conversation, you said you're concerned about this on a broader scale. Can you talk to us for a second, start off the conversation by talking to us about, you know, what is the nature of your concern of herbicide resistance, particularly as it relates to turf management?
Well, Frank, I certainly think we could. Well, first of all, thanks for having me today. Great to be with you. Great to talk with you about this topic. It certainly has been one dealing with herbicide-resistant weeds in turf. And, you know, the causes of that, the reasons for that, has been a major area that I've been into for about the past 4 to 5 years now. And, you know, I think it's like you said. I think it goes back to, let's start off with annual bluegrass.
Okay.
The worst weed in turf, one of the most widespread plant species in the world, from Antarctica to, you know, southern Florida, you know, across every continent. And
yeah,
we have a weed species that is problematic that we can all get behind as the worst weed species in turf around the world. And we only have so few herbicides we can use to control it. In warm season turf, if we talk about annual bluegrass,
mm-hmm,
we have a lot of post-emergent and pre-emergent herbicides out there. But if you start going down the list of what annual bluegrass has become resistant to, you really, at the end of the day, have only 2 to 3 herbicides to which no annual bluegrass population has been found resistant. Now, that's not saying that there's not just one population that's resistant to all of those, but you can definitely see that as things begin to move around and you see the possibility that different annual bluegrass populations could develop multiple site resistance as well. And the problem that I see, as you say, above the Mason-Dixon line in cool season turf, you have even less herbicides than what we have here in the southeast.
right.
Southeastern U.S., or just simply in warm season turf grass. With our dormancy period, with our differences between C4 and C3 physiology, we have a lot more selective herbicides available for annual bluegrass control in turf. But for cool season turf, if you start
right.
seeing broad scale resistance, the problem is even worse there. So I think the problem for cool season is that you have so few herbicides you start off to start with.
Right. Well, let me interrupt you now because this is perfect. And you know, you've published some work recently on glyphosate. Let's see if we can talk about one particular example and see if it cascades into a different conversation. But, you know, you recently published some work on sort of the mechanism of glyphosate resistance that you found in an annual bluegrass population. And
yeah.
So in that work, right, so let's just take that example because – as you know, and I know, it wasn't just a few years ago, we were actively thinking about a Roundup Ready bentgrass that would have led to a pretty regular use of Roundup and still might. I mean, I don't know that whether or not these products will come to the market. I'm not sure that the major companies have abandoned it or not. But, you know, this raises the question about this kind of management. Let's take annual bluegrass and glyphosate for an example. What is that really – what that's telling us, number one, glyphosate is a widely used material that I think for many, many years we weren't finding any resistance to. And now we're finding a lot of crops resistant to Roundup. Now it's made it to annual bluegrass. How does the way it's annual bluegrass has become resistant concern you for – other weed species like goosegrass, spotted spurge, sedge, crabgrass. How does that thing with annual blue?
Well, annual bluegrass, the work you're talking about was done by a graduate student at Clemson who actually worked under Burt McCarty, and I got to be a member of the committee being here at Auburn and working with those guys at Clemson.
Okay.
Great experience there, Bob. Dr. Cross now, an excellent student, excellent problem solver, did excellent work there. And if you look at glyphosate, Roundup use in the Southeast, it's primarily used for dormant weed control in dormant
right.
Bermuda grass turf.
Right.
So you have to have that absolute complete dormancy in order to make those applications. So that limits its potential use area. And but Dr. Cross actually found a target site resistance mechanism in there that was one of the causative factors, the primary causative factors leading to resistance. Okay, so you have a relatively simple mechanism, a point mutation that
mm-hmm.
can be transferred, you know, with the seed, or if it's cross-pollinated, actually could be carried on the pollen to actually cross-pollinate.
Right.
Luckily, Poa annua is primarily a sulfur, but if cross-pollination did occur, it could be carried that way. The issue, to me, I think the most important issue in talking about Roundup Ready bentgrass and the overuse of, no, I should say the overuse, but the extensive use of glyphosate or Roundup in the crops arena, you apply that to what could be done in cool season turf. Let's say we did get Roundup Ready creeping bentgrass. We know that there's Roundup resistant, glyphosate resistant populations of POA that has been found in South Carolina and elsewhere. We have populations from Alabama as well.
Mm-hmm.
That we haven't reported on yet. So it easily translates into an issue in cool season turf that we would begin to see resistance there. Thus, it would have to be you even somebody who purchased Roundup Ready creeping bentgrass down the road could not go with a Roundup-only type of system for weed
okay.
control. They would still need to integrate other types of management practices, both chemical and non-chemical, to reduce the impact of annual bluegrass in those areas and to introduce an additional mode of action, such as paclobutrazole, Trimit, So, you know, therein lies the issue to me is that mm-hmm. we know we have resistance in our dormant turf situations in the Southeast, mm-hmm. in warm season turf. I keep saying the mm-hmm. Southeast. I should just say warm season
turf. Yeah, no, it's good.
Turf.
It's good.
But now it really does not bode well for a potential Roundup-resistant creeping bentgrass.
Okay. Now, that said, when we were talking in preparation for this, one of the things that you said to me that really resonated that, you know, I think many people, especially in the North, you know, this is why I like having these conversations with, you know, guys who work outside of the typical growing areas that I travel into is that we can learn from each other. And for example, we've done a really good job, I think, in trying to get superintendents in the North who spray fungicides all the time, learning about the importance of rotating chemistries, of not particularly staying with a particular chemistry, learning about the mode of action, and then, you know, stewarding a product properly. Now, you said in our earlier conversation that the way products have evolved over the years and the loss of some of the hammers like MSMA or atrazine that have a broad, you know, sort of a broader knockdown, the transition in the chemistries that we use is also contributing to the problem. Can you take a minute and chat about the way you feel herbicide chemistry is changing and making this more difficult?
Well, certainly I can talk about it with respect to Roundup and with respect to herbicides in that sulfonylurea family. Everybody would mm-hmm. know those, like Monument, Revolver, as well as similarly acting ALS inhibitors in that ALS
Velocity.
Inhibitor class. Velocity, exactly. So
right.
I can definitely talk with those. Those herbicides are the most – there are more biotypes resistant to those herbicides than any other group. Matter of fact, it's almost like all the others combined are about the same number as the ALS inhibitors. So
it's an interesting question, right? Why the hell do we keep using these chemistries?
Yeah, they're so safe. They're such low use rates, and – They are what they're effective on. They're very effective, and they're the selectivity, the sheer amount of selectivity you get out of them, where you can apply it to a turf grass, such as a herbicide like Monument. You can apply it to a turf grass like Bermuda grass or Zoysia. No injury, not even any slowdown in growth. You control just about all the sedges out there. Annual bluegrass, some broadleaf weeds. You know, it truly is, you know, it's a very effective, very well-niched herbicide.
What you're describing is a broad spectrum, you know, low use rates, high safety on the turf that we use it on. I mean, it's as close as you're going to get to a miracle, but the downside is a single site of action, right?
Yeah, and there's no way around it. With something that simple, there was bound to be problems, and it had to be an ideal situation for the EPA when they're looking for herbicides and, you know, they're wanting to reduce the total amount of pesticide load in the environment, and you look at these herbicides and they're used at sub-ounces per acre, and they're very specifically targeted to plant metabolic processes. Mm-hmm. Ideal as far as safety is concerned. And the problem lies therein is that a single minor mutation, seemingly minor mutation, can completely negate the use of that herbicide on a resistant weed. So just use of these over time has just simply led to selecting for these random mutations that lead to resistance. And so, you know,
do some of the new products, at least coming to the market, especially the HPPD materials like mesotrione and Pylex, for example, do you think that some, because, you know, it's not like we've had an onslaught of new herbicide technology in the last 10 years. They're really hasn't been, I would say, maybe you're more familiar with me than me, but there really hasn't been any, you know, real shifts. We're still using dinitrolanilins, you know, we're still using oxidiazon. You know, now the HPPD materials come on. Let me ask you, do you see resistance on the horizon for those particular kinds of materials as well, like Tenacity and Pilex?
I would say not for those. Just simply, they're not used in high enough amounts right now. They're used in, they're such niche herbicides, and you just the number one thing you have to have for herbicide resistant selectivity to selection is for just sheer volume of use and exposure just to a sheer number of plants. And that's where annual bluegrass is so ideal. It's so widespread around the world. It's so widespread in warm season, cool season turf that we simply expose more herbicide to annual bluegrass, or expose more annual bluegrass to herbicides than any other species out there. So that's where selectivity starts. And right now, the use rates, not use rates, the use amounts of the carotenoid, those carotenoid HPPD biosynthesis inhibitors, are simply just not to that level. The one thing that does look like it, if anything's going to occur, it's some of the newer herbicides, like we have one in the southeast, it's Spectacle. And it's a cellulose biosynthesis inhibitor. And it has started to be used very widely in warm season turf.
Yeah.
Extremely effective. Low use rates again, and you know it's replacing a lot of things to which we have resistance to, and the concern
for me is that herbicide. Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, and you wonder, don't you sit and wonder sometimes if the regulatory process, the way it's set up, the way these companies have to approach developing new products, that it almost, you know, it's almost a setup for developing products they're likely to become resistant to, because we like low use. Everybody wants low use rates. Everybody wants high safety, although I understand Spectacle had its little issues when it was first launched, that there were some issues associated with that. But the broader, I mean, the bigger question is, you know, does the chemical development, does the regulatory process force companies to develop products that might have only a short shelf life?
Yeah, I don't know, quite honestly. Certainly there was this massive, if you look at the ALS inhibitors, there's more of those out there than any other families, any other group. There's just, especially the sulfonylureas, the last count, you know, I always hear the number around 140 have been patented or registered around the world, 140 sulfonylureas. So so a lot of these companies, I think, just have them on the shelf. And they're like, well, we have to do something with it. We know it works as a herbicide. We know it has a low use rate. We know it can get approval. So let's take the low-hanging fruit, I suppose, and see if we can get it work in the market. But if you go back to the cellulose biosynthesis inhibitors, and specifically to Spectacle, to Indazaflam, we just don't know if we're going to get resistance to that, because some people think it actually has multi sites of action. So it's not just inhibiting one thing. It's inhibiting multiple things. Like the ALS inhibitors, they inhibit one thing. They inhibit the ALS enzyme, period. That's it. Okay.
Yep.
These other ones, they may inhibit not only two, but three, four, or five different cellulose synthase enzymes. So if they do that, in order to get resistance, what you have to have is you have to have all of those mutate. And the chances to all those mutating at the same time is it's astronomical. The numbers is huge.
So listen, I mean, I want to take a break now. We've already burned up at least half our time together. That's how quickly this can go. But I want to return to the resistance issue when we come back after this message from our sponsor, Scott. And then I want to really get in a little bit of a conversation with our use of methiazolin on annual bluegrass. We'll be right back with Professor Scott McElroy. This is Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi.
Golf course superintendents all agree traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water filtration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zones all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and playable. Visit Drive.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking, having a lively conversation with my friend from Auburn University, Professor Scott McElroy, talking about herbicide resistance. Scott, and where we left off, you raised an interesting point about when an herbicide has multiple sites of action, right? But I want to ask you, as we make this transition to spending our last 15, 20 minutes together, I want to make this transition to annual bluegrass. And I'm assuming, and I'll just say it, and I could be wrong about it, but if we've got populations of annual bluegrass resistant to Roundup, now we think we might have populations of annual bluegrass that might be resistant to Velocity or ALS herbicides. Obviously, plants can develop multiple site resistance, even though the odds of it, as you said, are fairly low. It can happen, and based on your model, that you know the sheer volume of material that will get used, you and I know when products come along that could be like methiazolin are that might see widespread use on a lot of plants. I want to tie this together in a question, but how concerned are you about just generally annual bluegrass in the South, in the North, developing multiple resistance to a variety of products?
It's inevitable that it's going to happen.
It's inevitable, yes.
Unless there is a strategic plan to more thought begins to go into managing or being stewards of the chemistry of the technology, and that's the way you've got to view these herbicides, as the technology and protecting that technology for future use. It's inevitable that it's going to happen.
Okay.
Because our current way of thinking, really, in so many ways with so many people, is it's not a problem until it's a problem. And that's the way people tend to approach herbicide resistance, whether it's in crops or whether it's in turf. It's not a problem for them until it's a problem. And then it's a major problem.
Well, but so, yeah, then we find ourselves where agriculture is now, where, you know, their vision of crop rotation is 1 year I use Roundup Ready, the next year I use ALS Ready, the next year I use Phenoxy Ready, right? And then I go back to Roundup Ready. I mean, that's the sort of, I got the sarcastic view of crop rotation in production agriculture is just, you know, continuing to, that's not really stewarding a compound. Well, since you brought it up, whose responsibility is that? Is that the chemical company's responsibility to get it labeled in a way that promotes stewardship, or is it really to the golf superintendent industry or the turf industry, the users, to properly steward that chemistry?
I think it's both. I think you cannot take the responsibility off of any one group. And I certainly think it's the responsibility of the chemical industry to take seriously the idea that weeds can become resistant to their products. And it's also the end user has to take some of that responsibility on as well. It cannot be any one group's just their fault per se, but you know, everybody has to take some responsibility to that. You know,
you go back to methiazolin too.
Okay, yeah. So we have this herbicide POA. It's going to be called POA Cure methiazolin.
Right, okay.
Hopefully, it becomes registered in the near future. You know, whose responsibility is that to steward that product? And, you know, it's got to be both. It's got to be the company who produces it and sells that product has got to have some language on the label that, you know, that tells superintendents, you don't just use this product. Use other products, integrate these types of strategies. And it has to be the responsibility of the end user to recognize the technology that they have in their hands and do everything they can to preserve that. It has to be both groups that does it.
Well, and I think, you know, I agree with you wholeheartedly. but I have to, there is, you know, my sarcastic Northeast side says, when you find a chemical company that's willing to tell people not to spray their product, you let me know. Because maybe, you know, maybe they're going to be popular. That's why I'm glad that you articulated it is a partnership and it is something that we have to work on together. But, you know, sometimes the industry isn't set up to nurture that joint stewardship. Now, let's leave that point there because
we're doing a really nice job. We're going political all of a sudden there, Frank.
Yeah. So let's get to methiazolin because I know, you know, you've published some work on it. Askew's published some work on it. SJ was the graduate student right after I left working with Joe Neal. SJ came right behind me. So I, of course, knowing it's a Cornelian that developed this technology warms my heart to no end. But let me say a few things of what I think is the sort of general thinking from the EUP that's been out there, and then I'll have you comment on it. First of all, I think one of the things that SJ figured out early on was it wasn't that you just needed an herbicide to kill annual bluegrass, particularly in its toughest location on a putting green, but you needed it to kill it in a time course as opposed to, you know, like an HPPD material that turns it white and then it starts to fade away. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about the strategy involved in the way this compound works. You found that it's root absorbed, primarily moves up, not much basopetal movement, but you did find that there is some absorption into the leaves. So first of all, do you have any suspicion that the absorption translocation part of the equation is part of the reason it works the way it does? Does it move slowly? Is it absorbed slowly? Does it live in the soil longer? Let's start with the strategy behind sort of the way it works.
Yeah, so I think, you know, nothing starting off about the physiology, more so of, I think you kind of hit on this, was the fact that you don't want to kill the POA fast, especially
right.
in a putting green. If you're dealing with a 50-50 bent POA putting green, you do not want to kill it in a hurry. We want to slowly take this out. And I think that's where methiazolin really fits well. You have to start off with lower rates that you slowly begin to take it out over time with these lower rates. And then over a 6 to 12-month period, you can end up with an area that has been cleaned of POA, and nobody's the wiser that anything even occurred, anything was even sprayed. That's the ideal situation. And I think it is the low absorption into the plant, the lower translocation that actually occurs, is definitely contributing to that, and it's just a slow acting herbicide as well. I mean, it just takes time to for the control just to actually occur. So
right,
you know,
so the strategy is there. It has something to do with the way it's taken up and moving around. But you know, I mean, you know, you've been in weed science. Well, you know, you're still a youngster compared to me, but I'm long in the tooth now. And I would tell you, you don't see a lot of herbicides come to the market that take 6 to 12 months to work that anyone is going to be interested in buying. So
That
is an interesting concept in and of itself. And the thing I found fascinating in your paper is the persistent pre-activity.
Yeah.
So back to what I'm trying to do is see if we can dovetail the resistance conversation with some exciting technology that may or likely might not, who likely may, hopefully does, may have some restrictions when it makes it to the market. How concerned are you about the fact that the stuff sort of sits there for a while active? Is that going to lead to resistance problems, the fact that the plants are constantly exposed to it?
Anytime it goes back to this concept, the more plants you can expose that herbicide to, the greater your chance for resistance.
Right.
But in order to kill a plant, you've actually got to expose them to the herbicide. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's the very nature of utilizing that herbicide is what leads to control, or what leads to resistance. So,
right.
I would say that it definitely goes back to the stewardship. You're going to use different modes of action. You're going to have to. Nobody's going to stop spraying Trimet all of a sudden. It's still a herbicide that's going to have to be utilized after the population has been controlled, to simply help hold off control and to manage for potential resistance. We can't simply throw Trimet out the door because it is a valuable product. And that's a product that if it were coming to the market today as a brand new herbicide, people would be extremely excited about it.
Right.
In the same way that people are excited about Poacur or methiazolin. Because
okay.
It is very effective in what it does when it's used in the proper way. It's a niche herbicide or niche plant growth regulator that can be used as a herbicide. And so,
have there ever been any reports of annual bluegrass resistance to pacrobutazole?
No, and that's one thing I would ask you. I mean, do you hear of people who are seeing reduced control? And are you hearing of people who have continually used paclobutrazole for POA control for a number of years, and they're not seeing the level of control they once did? I would not be surprised that it's out there. It's simply, in many ways, golf course superintendents especially are the last to report. Simply they think, well, somebody misapplied, let me go apply it again. Or they think, you know, because there's always problems that are occurring that lead to the, you know, lack of effectiveness of a pesticide of any kind, and they are the first ones to lay the blame on themselves in those situations. So
and I would say to you that I couldn't say specifically in the hundreds of golf courses I walk on annually that anybody's ever come out and said, I think I've got POA that's making, you know, that pacrobutrazole is not getting. However, I will tell you, there is there's a couple of things that come to mind. First of all, I think that pacrobutrazole, for whatever reason, is well known that it rarely is going to take. I mean, you can go from 70% to 50% to 30% to 10% and even to 5%, Scott. But I will tell you, most guys will say to me, you can't get to zero. You're still going to have some there.
Yeah,
now,
I agree with that completely.
If that's resistance.
Yeah, I don't know, because I feel the exact same way. It seems like you can whittle that population down, but there is some residual annual bluegrass that just hangs around and will not go away. And I have no idea. I don't know if that's resistant or not. I mean, we can definitely pull those plants, begin to propagate them, and then begin to compare them to a control population and find out. But I just don't know if that's technically resistant.
Well, and then, I mean, to me, the other side is, I have to be honest and say, I think a lot of guys on cool season putting surfaces, and you see it, I think, on warm season putting surfaces with Primo, the less those putting surfaces grow, the better every superintendent likes it. And so they've started to use, obviously, the Trimet is a good herbicide. And not only that, but Scott, I tell you, one of the things we're starting to see, and this is a whole nother thing, is that guys that have regrassed, the preponderance of regrassing that's occurred in the north, primarily in response a lot to the recent winter damage, we've seen a big spur in new bentgrass greens with winter damage. There's a lot of new varieties on the market that guys are trying. Guys are getting sick of spraying every week for anthracnose. So there's definitely a movement to more bentgrass. And those guys are on Trimet right away. But now they're going to pacrobutrazole plus fluoroprimidol. And they're going to a three-way pacrobutrazole, fluoroprimidol, and trinexipac. And so they're using them as herbicides, but they're getting the benefits of regulation as well. And that's why, you know, I wonder, based on our conversation, are we really plowing the ground for what ultimately might be multiple resistance to, you know, three growth regulators now that we've been doing this? I'm sort of curious about whether that's developing or not, but because the guys are getting side benefits from the PGRs, I see rates going up. I see frequencies narrowing. And I wonder if that isn't a bit of a harbinger for us that we might want to be careful about that.
Yeah. You know, I would say yes. You know, I mean, I think there is, anytime we're putting these foreign chemicals out there for herbicide purposes, you're putting selection pressure. And anytime we put selection pressure, we are asking, we're asking life to change, to adapt to that. Right. And that is what life does. And that is what any organism is going to do if you put it under selection pressure and you tell it either to tolerate this or to die. It's going to figure out eventually a way to tolerate that.
So with that as a backdrop, as we wrap up here, Scott, in the last 5 minutes, let me ask you a really just straightforward question about methiazolan, and that is this. You know, the USGA, in response to the winter damage a couple years ago, the growing problems with anthracnose, have really tried to encourage golf superintendents throughout northern climates to consider putting in more bent grass. And so I do think we're going to continue to see more bent grass. So I think some of that is based on the confidence that ultimately methiazolan will in fact be labeled. But if you built a, let's say I just made you the golf superintendent, at Belle Reve in St. Louis, where they decided to put in bentgrass greens in hopes the pole will stay out, and you had to develop a methiazolan program with a new bentgrass green, would you start immediately making pre-apps, or would you start with other chemicals? Tell me how you would steward methiazolan on a new putting surface.
I'd probably go with spring and fall apps. I'd just go with maintenance, spring and a fall app of maintenance integrated in with lower rates of paclobutrazole. Mm-hmm. Is the way I would probably approach it at this time. And also trying to manage the greens complex and surrounds as well as strictly as I could for annual bluegrass to make sure that I'm limiting the amount of POA in those infestations that could serve as a seed source getting
right
into those areas. And overall, you know, just trying to have good management, trying to reduce the amount of phosphorus inputs, to utilize increased iron inputs if possible, decrease the amount of nitrogen when, you know, in lower nitrogen spoon feeding type situations.
Right.
You know, still maintaining
cultural,
as much.
Yeah. All the cultural practices, right? I mean, to me, when we get a bentgrass green that's nice and clean and you got new surrounds, maybe even, now you're on an exclusion program versus an eradication program that you develop once you've got a problem and you're trying to bring it to zero. Certainly a lot of guys are going to do that. Now, Scott, before I let you go, I'm going to ask you the million-dollar question for a warm season guy. Do you ever foresee being able to take off types out of Bermuda grass? Do you believe there's ever going to be a chemical that is going to allow us to keep some of these Bermuda grass stands clean?
Well, never say never, but it certainly does sound far-reaching, that's for sure.
It does.
Yeah. So,
it is pretty far-reaching because, I mean, that is a big issue for a lot of the Bermuda grass guys, yes?
Yeah, it is. It's a huge issue. It's, you know, from the, you know, turf quality standpoint and, you know, just the frustration with, you know, differences. We see a lot of differences in the off types and their response to Primo, to Trinex Pack, and the way that some of these just don't growth regulate at all or very little, and you get the scalping, this lack of quality. So yeah, it's a really big issue. But you know, I would definitely say never because there's RNAi technology. There's, you know, that a lot of people may not know about, and there's possibilities there. You kind of see how that technology can fit, but getting it to work is, you know, who knows if something like that happens down the road.
And there you go, Professor Scott McElroy, Auburn University. Scott, what a joy talking to you. I hope I try the best I can not to offend my guests. I hope I didn't do that with you, and that you'll take some time and join us again to have some more weed control conversation.
My pleasure. Anytime you need me, Dr. Rossi, please don't hesitate.
Thank you very much. Professor Scott McElroy, Auburn University. I'm Frank Rossi. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking. Look forward to having you back on another episode.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.